From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the historian and journalist Yoni Applebaum makes the case for impeachment. Not just the case for impeaching Donald Trump, though he does do that, but Applebaum explains how the impeachment process isn't extreme or chaotic. It was designed by the framers as an orderly process to decide if a president is morally fit to serve. He says it's in the Constitution for a reason. We'll be right back.
Hey there, podcast listener. I'm Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. If you enjoy the show, we'd appreciate it if you did us a little favor. Find us on the iTunes store and leave us a review. Let us know what you think. It's valuable feedback for us, and frankly, the more reviews we have, the more listeners we can attract. Thanks in advance. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the show.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For a lot of political observers and mainstream Americans, the idea of impeachment seems drastic. Removing a president from office is a big deal, of course, and we've never done it. But here's the thing. Impeachment doesn't necessarily mean you remove a president from office. The House of Representatives has impeached three presidents: Andrew Johnson in the 1860s, Richard Nixon, Bill Clinton. This is something the historian and journalist Yoni Applebaum writes about in a recent article in The Atlantic, that impeachment isn't an outcome. It's a process. A process designed by the framers of the Constitution to be careful and orderly, to consider evidence, to formulate charges, and then to decide whether to continue on to a trial. His article is a case for impeachment, but it's also a case for why Congress should begin right now to impeach Donald Trump. Applebaum's article is Impeach Donald Trump, and he's joining us today to talk about it. Yoni Applebaum is a former professor of history at Harvard. He's now a senior editor at The Atlantic, and he joined us from a studio at The Atlantic's offices in Washington, D.C. I guess I wanted to begin this way. I wanted to ask you to summarize the case against Donald Trump, first thing, which you do, of course, in the piece. And you say the president has not kept the promise of his oath, and you say that is not, you don't think, a partisan judgment. Begin there, if you would, the case as you see it against Donald Trump.
One of the striking features of this presidency is that many of its most vociferous critics are people who identified with or continue to identify with the president's party, but look at his performance on the campaign trail and in office and recoil in horror. The question of impeachment is a complicated one, and we'll walk all the way through it. But at its core, it's a judgment of a president's fitness to hold office. When a president takes the oath of office at his inauguration, he swears to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. And the Constitution lays relatively few obligations on the president, but he is supposed to uphold the laws and execute them in good faith. He is obliged to preside over the executive and to respect the Constitution and its balance of powers. And when a president departs from those responsibilities, the Constitution builds in a remedy, and that remedy is impeachment. And so I think that the case against Donald Trump has many specifics, but they come down to this, that he hasn't either upheld the basic duties of a president in the fair and impartial administration of the law, nor has he succeeded in differentiating between his own private and familial interests and those of the country that he is sworn to serve.
Gets to this question, it seems like. You say the one question or the critical question that determines whether an act is impeachable is whether it, quote you here, endangers American democracy, that it has attacked the bedrock of American democracy. Explain what you mean by that, because I guess you could perceive that in some ways as subjective, but you have a particular idea of what that means.
Right. And impeachment is not a typical legal process. Yeah. And so, for example, it's not conceived of as a punishment. It's it it's a process that starts with an inquiry and builds toward the impeachment itself, which is like an indictment, and then on to a trial and then ultimately removal. So the sanction here is removal from office. And I think that's really important when you're thinking about what kinds of offenses qualify. There's a broad legal, no, not universal, but a broad legal consensus that not all criminal acts are impeachable. Yeah. And that not all impeachable offenses are criminal. And I think that's sort of the first thing to wrap our minds around. The president can kick a shrub on federal property in Washington, D.C. and will undeniably have committed a criminal act. But it wouldn't be an impeachable offense because it doesn't meet this other test. And this other test is the offense such that it threatens the basic fabric of American democracy? You don't want to proceed down the path of impeachment lightly. What you're looking for are acts which don't merely violate standards or statutes, but acts that in so doing somehow threaten the balance of the system itself. And so things like the subversion of justice or its use for partisan ends have traditionally been regarded as impeachable offenses because they go beyond a statutory violation. In fact, they may not entail a statutory violation, but they move us into the territory where the president's actions are threatening the stability of the system.
It's interesting to hear the way you explained how the framers of the Constitution were kind of vague about this at first. And they come down to these particular offenses that were impeachable: treason, bribery, and then other high crimes and misdemeanors. And that's usually the one that is applied, high crimes and misdemeanors. And it's interesting you say that high crimes and misdemeanors, the framers didn't just want to remove a president for bribery or treason. They wanted that something else, that was important to them, that it not just be, what, a technical legal thing, but again, getting at the essential, what, duties of the president, I guess.
Yeah, they're creating this sort of amazing thing. The presidency they endow with powers that no king of England has exercised in about 200 years at the time they draft the Constitution. They're creating one of the strongest central leader in the Anglosphere. And they're very conscious of the power that they're giving to this new office. They're very conscious as well of human frailty and fragility. And so they become, during the convention, a little bit preoccupied at times with this question of how you keep a system like that from going out of kilter. If you're going to restore many of these powers that monarchs themselves are no longer exercising and create a new American monarch in the person of the president. How do you do that safely? Well, one answer that everyone's familiar with from their high school civics class is checks and balances. That there are a variety of procedural mechanisms that limit the power of the president, even as that power remains much more sweeping than that King George III possessed at the time. The other thing they think about and think about hard is this question of impeachment for the president and for other federal officers. That they're concerned that there needs to be some sort of a way for a president who oversteps his bounds, and they seem to regard this almost as an inevitability because they are keenly aware of human nature, to be called to account and removed from office if necessary. And then it becomes a debate over what those grounds should be. Certainly treason, bribery, but that's not sufficient. There is this moment where one member of the convention steps forward and sort of says, well, what if it's something else? The Constitution does not reach many great and dangerous offenses, says George Mason. Attempts to subvert the Constitution may not be treason, as above defined. Mason's pointing to this real danger that exists. You could have a president who is bribed, that is, paid to serve somebody else's interest, or committing treason, that is, serving the interests of a foreign power. But that doesn't exhaust the ways that you can subvert or undermine the Constitution. He could, for example, be serving his own self-interest in ways that go beyond the Constitution. And he points toward an impeachment proceeding that's then underway in England as an example. The impeachment of Hastings over his service in India. And he suggests maladministration. What if he's just not a very good president? Yeah. And Madison is not on board with this and sort of steps back and says, well, that pretty much gives us tenure during the pleasure of the Senate. If it's just maladministration, any president could be accused of that. And so a president could only stay in office as long as at least a third of the Senate supports him. But they settle on this phrase, high crimes and misdemeanors, which has a particular technical meaning in English law that they're probably at least somewhat aware of. And it encompasses this broad range of offenses. But you can think of the three of them arrayed in sequence, right? Treason, bribery, high crimes and misdemeanors. And if the third term at all resembles the first two, what you're talking about are a set of offenses in office in which a president betrays his basic duty to the nation. So there's a gravity that attaches to the first two that should attach to the third, but also a sort of a misidentification of interest. If the fundamental problem of treason is that you're serving the interests of a foreign power, the fundamental problem of bribery is that you're serving the interests of the person who is paying you, the fundamental problems of the other high crimes and misdemeanors should probably be alike in kind. They should entail a president not serving the public interest in some way or another. And indeed, that's how many constitutional scholars have since read them.
One of the things you write about is how maybe American voters haven't grasped the gravity of what that high crimes and misdemeanors is getting at. Because you say American voters want to see more, you know, concrete legal charges because they have, and this is how you put it in the article, long since lost the moral vocabulary to articulate concerns about character and honor. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, and it's not just the voters, I should say. It's a plurality of the House and a majority of the Senate have law degrees.
Right.
We are governed by lawyers who tend to think just as voters do in these very concrete terms. You know, this nation was born largely in a system of common law, of precedents, and has evolved more and more toward a system of statutory law in which offenses are explicitly spelled out. You gain lots of things by doing that, but it also limits the moral imagination in some really worrying ways. If you think about what the founders are really concerned about in a president who's gone off the tracks, they left the language deliberately vague because they understood that there's lots of ways to do this that would comply with statutes, but would be so obviously unconstitutional in a broader sense as to warrant Congress's action. We don't think in quite this way. Everybody who is concerned about the Trump presidency will do their best to articulate these concerns, but you can see sometimes people will reach for psychiatric manuals or they'll reach for other kinds of specific offenses that they'll accuse the president of having committed. You tend to encounter with less frequency words like honor or character or duty, although these are the terms in which the founders spoke. And so there's often sort of this disjunct in the conversation between the intuitions that many Americans have, that there is a man who is president of the United States who is, in some fundamental and characterological sense, not fit for that office and not properly discharging it, and then their quest to find the specific offenses that they can attach to this person, all motivated by that broader sense of failure. The same offenses in another individual might not generate the same degree of alarm, but perhaps actually lacking the moral vocabulary to articulate what it is that their intuition is telling them.
To what degree is impeachment a political process? Because I hear that all the time. Well, it's not criminal, it's a political process. And when it's talked about, and often it's when it's talked about as a political process, it's talked about as if that's a bad thing, like that's a pejorative. How do you explain how it fits in a political process?
Sure. So, it's obviously a political process because it's something that Congress does.
Yeah.
And so the framers of the Constitution had this choice that they debate, whether to rest this power in the Supreme Court or in Congress. And they decide on Congress. Congress is like the presidency. It's elective, right? So this is a democratic process in which the people have sent their representatives to Washington, and they have also sent the president to Washington. So it's not an anti-democratic process. It is a political one. But that does not necessarily mean that it must be a partisan one. And we sometimes use those words interchangeably. It's political in the sense that it is a mechanism of our politics. We have a government. Everything that government does is inherently political. And Congress is called upon to judge in the broadest sense of the word the fitness of a president for office as a political matter. That is he capable of discharging the office? Is he doing so in a way consonant with his oath? Are the violations that Congress can document sufficiently grave to justify the extraordinary step of impeachment and removal? Those are necessarily political judgments. It doesn't matter whether you house them within the Supreme Court or house them within Congress. Those are political questions. The problem is that people sometimes use the word political in a narrower sense, as if to say, impeachment is simply a question of partisan self-interest. We can expect that any party would always move against the president of another party, if only one party is alarmed, that should delegitimize the entire process because it ought to be, in some sense, above politics. This is, I think, a fundamental misunderstanding of the process. It does not give free rein to Congress to simply accuse a president and attempt to remove him. The closest we've come to that, I think, probably was the impeachment of Bill Clinton, a process that moved forward without independent inquiry within Congress that was in many ways misbegotten and then was rejected both by the Senate and by large majorities of the American public. When the process appears to be a process embarked upon for narrow partisan advantage, it tends not to work. Mm-hmm. But we've had other impeachments that have moved forward against presidents and other officials that have been partisan in their alignment, but the charges themselves have been political in this broader sense, charges of a betrayal of fundamental duties, and those have turned out rather differently. So it is political, but that in some sense ought to be a call to Congress to think in the broadest possible terms about its duties rather than in the narrowest terms about the prospect for re-election in 20 months' time.
Yoni Applebaum, he's a senior editor at The Atlantic magazine. His article, The Case for Impeachment, appeared in a recent issue of the magazine. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
Do you work for the University of Utah? Are you a public radio nerd? Then donate to KUER through payroll deduction. Decide how much of your paycheck you'd like to put toward programming like Morning Edition, 1A, and Radio West, and the university will send your generous gift to KUER. Your contribution supports factual journalism, Utah stories, and even short films. Get started with payroll deduction by looking under the support tab at KUER.org.
This is Radio West and Beck Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the historian and journalist Yoni Applebaum. He's making the case for impeachment. Applebaum is a senior editor at The Atlantic magazine. He joined us from The Atlantic's offices in Washington, D.C. The Atlantic has published an editor's note to go along with your piece from Jeffrey Goldberg, the editor-in-chief. And Goldberg's initial thoughts about impeachment seem to reflect what a lot of people are thinking. And that is, as he says in his note, impeachment, as I had previously understood it, seemed like a formula for chaos. And a sort of chaos, he says, that no fractured nation needs. Talk a little bit about that, because you address this concern, this reticence to go forward with something that seems so drastic. Because I think you're seeing that as a kind of misunderstanding of the way it's supposed to work.
Yes. So I actually started in the same point. I thought of impeachment as a mistake and something that would inject and accelerate disorder in the American political system. And did not start to write the article that I ended up writing. The original draft of this was 4,000 words on the impeachment of Andrew Johnson. I'm a historian by training, and I'd gone back to look at that earlier episode, as historians do, to use the past to illuminate the present. But what I found there and more broadly as I looked into impeachment surprised me and pushed me in a different direction. And my thinking on this evolved, and it evolved in response to how impeachment has actually worked. So my concerns about it were largely theoretical and grounded in one incident, the most recent incident, the impeachment of Bill Clinton. And the argument that emerged was instead historical, grounded in a much longer experience and some more directly parallel cases. And what I came to understand was that impeachment is best thought of as a procedure, a process, not an outcome. Right. Often when people say, should we impeach the president, what they mean essentially is some version of, should tomorrow 67 senators vote to remove him from office? And this is really the wrong way to think about it. That is reasoning from the point of view of outcomes. There's been a lot of that lately.
Yeah.
In fact, one of the most persistent critiques of this president is that he reasons everything from the point of view of outcomes. Well, you know, the remedy for that is actually a focus on process and procedure. And in this case, there's a lot of wild charges already out there being flung against the president, and some very grave charges that appear to be substantiated by evidence. But we don't really have a good mechanism for adjudicating them. We don't have a mechanism for reviewing them, for hearing the evidence, for putting it on the public record, for having witnesses cross-examined, for building a case. Largely, this is being adjudicated on cable news panels, which is, I think we can all agree, none of us would want our fates dependent on the outcome of a cable news panel. And so impeachment as a process gives us a way to write the system. And it's a mechanism which is built into the system itself. It says, if things are going awry, if the president is overstepping his bounds, the proper remedy to that is a return to process and procedure and order. And in fact, that is what the folks most involved in the Nixon impeachment process ended up discovering, that process of pushing back against the president, although chaotic in the moment, led over the next decade to a whole set of reforms in American governance, to recommitment to order and procedure, and you know, really led to a remarkable flowering of congressional initiatives, not to disorder and chaos. In fact, that process put an end to the disorder and chaos which had marked certainly Nixon's second term in office and really before that as well.
Yeah.
And so I think that many of these concerns are really fundamentally earnest but misplaced, that rather than seeing impeachment as some threat to the American political order, what we should recognize is the clear, imminent, and growing threat to the American political order is our refusal to contemplate it, to put these passions into the process that was devised for their resolution, and instead to allow them to distort everything else.
Because it seems like in the absence of some sort of process, you get aides and government bureaucrats disregarding Donald Trump's orders or writing op-eds saying there's this resistance inside the executive branch. I guess from your perspective, that's the chaos we should be avoiding.
Right. You know, I think that this is actually damage which is going to be with us for a very long time. The Trump administration has lost more than five dozen times in federal court on a really wide array of issues. Many of those rulings essentially rest on the way this man is governing rather than the decisions themselves. They're oriented toward the lack of process, toward the capriciousness, the arbitrariness of the rulemaking, and toward the president's public statements. Those precedents will still be binding on his successor in office. When the system doesn't act the way it should, other elements will come into play that attempt to constrain a president who has gone off the rails. But that will have lasting consequences. So we're seeing it in the courts. We're seeing it even more acutely within the executive branch, where there's all kinds of stories on the record by senior Trump administration appointees who are telling us that they are routinely disregarding the president's orders, who are telling us that they are working actively to countermand his will. Well, they hold their jobs because President Trump won the election. Yeah. It is not, in fact, their role to disregard those orders they conceive of as unwise or running contrary to the evidence. And yet, Congress has not stepped in. Yeah. And so many of these people view it as their civic duty to do so. But again, you know, do you really want Donald Trump's successor to give an order to the Pentagon and have the defense secretary sit on it because he disagrees with it? I don't think you do. I don't think we even really want it happening now. But the longer that we don't put this debate over whether or not the president is fit to issue these orders into the one venue for its resolution, the more and more really disturbing precedents we're going to establish in ways that will do lasting damage to the system as a whole. So we have to think beyond the next 2 years or 4 years or 4 years beyond that, I should say. We really have to think beyond the next 2 years or 6 years to think about the lasting damage to the system that unresolved charges of unfitness are going to do.
Seems like some of the reluctance that you're hearing about impeachment is less about a misunderstanding of the constitutional process than it is a tactical political concern. So when Nancy Pelosi says it's too early to talk about impeachment, or when Democratic candidates for president, avoid the subject on the stump, they're just anticipating how this could go badly for them politically. Talk about that part of it, because you address this in your article as well.
Yeah, I mean, I understand those concerns, but I think they're wrong in three fairly profound ways. The first is that they're rooted in a very particular experience. Yeah. The House leadership not only lived through the Clinton impeachment, its members, the three senior House Democrats, were all serving during the Clinton impeachment. Right. And when you listen to them talk, it's clear that this is what has shaped their view, that if a Congress, if a House were to impeach and not get the votes in the Senate, it would only stir public sympathy for the president. It would boost his popularity. It would backfire. It would leave him strengthened. And, that would be a compelling argument if you thought the things that you were accusing Donald Trump of were fundamentally similar to the things that Bill Clinton stood accused of, or if you decided to replicate the misbegotten process. The House in the Clinton impeachment, it was a lame duck House that had already been rebuked at the polls. And then rather than holding any hearings of its own, heard from a single witness, Ken Starr, before moving the articles of impeachment to the floor and approving them on strictly partisan lines. It was not the way it was supposed to work. It was a short-circuiting of the process rather than allowing the process to unfold as it should, rather than airing the evidence and hearing from the witnesses and putting the whole thing into the public record. And it backfired on Republicans quite predictably. Mm-hmm. But you can also look at other impeachment processes that took place before any member of the House was elected, and in some cases before any member of the House was born, and see the whole thing playing out rather differently, where impeachment actually can be remarkably effective in a variety of ways. So that's one way that I think they're wrong. I think they're looking at the most recent case and drawing the wrong lessons out of it. The second way I think they're wrong about this is in presuming that they can simply damage Donald Trump politically by having a bunch of hearings with the intent of embarrassing him and damaging him politically, then romp in the 2020 election and control the House, the Senate, and the presidency. That's because I do not share their confidence that this is how this will play out. We don't know who will win in 2020. Presidential elections give the voters in this country a binary choice. However repugnant many Republicans find Donald Trump, when asked to choose whether a Republican or a Democrat should control the White House for the next 4 years, they may well look at the Democratic Party's nominee and decide that Trump is, for example, a philanderer, a self-admitted sexual assaulter, and a serial liar, and yet the lesser of two evils. All of those things are admitted out of Trump's own mouth prior to the 2016 election and did not deter voters from voting for him. And so I'm not sure that political calculus bears out. But even if it did, and I think this is probably the most essential point, there is something cynical and wrong in approaching impeachment from this perspective. It ratifies the narrowest view of impeachment as politics. It's a tool for damaging the president. We'll employ it at the moment where we think we can do the most damage. And if we think that it will do more damage to proceed down some other avenue, that's what we'd rather do instead. Impeachment is a duty. And those members of Congress swore an oath to protect and defend the Constitution, and that's what they ought to do. If they think that impeachment is merited, and the way Speaker Pelosi, the way Chairman Nadler speak about this president, they leave no doubt that they think that he has committed impeachable offenses, that they think that he is unfit for office. I know that because Nancy Pelosi said last week that she thinks he's unfit for office.
Right.
Well, if that's what she thinks and that's what she's publicly said, she has a duty to act on that belief. It is incredibly damaging to the system to have the leaders of the opposition stand up and announce that the president has committed presumptively impeachable offenses or that he is unfit for the office he holds and then refuse to act on it because they think it'll help him in the next election not to act now. That is cynical politics, not impeachment.
Just as a tactical maneuver, if you're a Democrat, and you address this too in your piece, why not just be patient and wait to see what comes of the Robert Mueller investigation? But you say that is, outsourcing congressional responsibility to someone else. And plus, you say you don't really think the Mueller report is going to be all that, you know, is going to really settle things. Just mention that if you would.
Yeah. So, you know, when you ask Democrats on the Hill, why aren't you moving forward with this? They'll usually give you one of two answers. Either they'll say, we're having a lot of hearings, which is sort of precisely the problem. They're having all kinds of hearings with all kinds of people without a single focused inquiry that could draw these threads together. But the other answer you'll get all the time is we're waiting for the Mueller report. And after a while, I started referring to this as Deus Ex Mueller, that this belief that there's going to be some magical intervention that will alleviate the need for Congress to intervene and to actually fulfill its duties. And they're likely to be disappointed in several ways. The first is Robert Mueller has a relatively narrow ambit. He's supposed to look at potential collusion between the president's campaign in Russia and Russia's electoral interference in 2016. That will not get into the question of whether or not the president is violating the Emoluments Clause and profiting off the presidency. It will not touch the fact that the president's personal attorney has said that the president directed him in the commission of campaign finance crimes. It will not get into whether or not the president lied or falsified loan or insurance applications, as the New York Attorney General is presently investigating, in ways that continue to bear on his private interests in office. There's sort of an endless list of things that Robert Mueller is not examining and that Congress has the capacity to examine. And there's no reason for it not to get rolling on these other fronts while it waits to hear from Mueller. The second is that Robert Mueller can't indict the president under DOJ guidelines, and there's no indication so far that Mueller, who's sort of the ultimate by-the-book prosecutor, has any inclination to break with them. A sitting president can't be indicted by the Department of Justice. The people who take that position, and I think this is really interesting, include the new attorney general, who wrote a memo about how deeply he believes that sitting presidents can't be indicted and the limits on whether or not there's criminal liability for things like obstruction of justice. Well, the punchline of that memo is actually something which hasn't received enough attention. It's that Barr doesn't think that a president can be held accountable as a legal matter because impeachment is the proper mechanism.
Yeah.
And so the most that Congress is going to get from Robert Mueller is a truly damning report backed by detailed evidence, which says, now it's up to you. And it may get quite a bit less. Robert Mueller's report could be a single sentence. I have indicted those people for whom I had sufficient evidence. All others whom I investigated, I did not find sufficient evidence of criminal acts.
Yeah.
This concludes my investigation. I don't know that we'll get anything more than that, and neither does Congress. And so to put all your eggs in that basket and to assume that you'll get something more detailed seems wrong. And even if Congress does, that will be the starting gun in its own investigation. It won't want to replicate the errors of the Republican Congress under Newt Gingrich and try to charge ahead solely on the basis of the Mueller report. If it's learned anything from that, I hope it's learned that it has an independent responsibility to review the evidence and hear from witnesses. And if it's going to do that, there's no reason to wait for the Mueller report to get started.
Well, you also mentioned how the process, if you actually then engage in and authorize in an official impeachment inquiry, you're able to start going through all the crazy theories that have been swirling about and the charges and the rumors and find some sort of coherent picture. And you point out that this process actually brings out or could potentially bring out actual evidence. I mean, the thing that really undid Richard Nixon, you say, came out during the impeachment inquiry process.
Right. And that actually cuts both ways. We usually talk about impeachment as a politician's worst nightmare. Well, two sitting vice presidents of the United States asked the House of Representatives to begin impeachment proceedings against them because they wanted to clear their names and they couldn't think of any other way to do it. Impeachment is a process of discernment and discovery. And so as Congress hires a professional staff, hopefully on a bipartisan basis, career prosecutors, investigators, start sifting through the evidence, starts interviewing witnesses in private, and then eventually calling them to public hearings, what you hope will happen, what I would expect to happen, is that it will start to differentiate between the wild, scurrilous, or unfounded charges, those that are plausible but unevidenced, and those where there is sufficient evidence to prove guilt or culpability or misconduct. It can't start that process without starting the hearings. And this is exactly how it's played out in the past. So when hearings against Andrew Johnson started in the 1860s, the first year of hearings examined charges like, oh, he plotted with John Wilkes Booth to kill Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah.
That is a serious charge leveled by a sitting congressman who said he had evidence. By the end, he was forced to testify before the committee and admit that the evidence was not what other people would call legal evidence. But it was a serious charge. Mm-hmm. And in the paranoid atmosphere of 1860s Washington, many people took it profoundly seriously. There was some circumstantial evidence that they were able to point to. Ultimately, like a lot of circumstantial evidence, it turned out to be coincidences and not causes. But until you have hearings and solicit public testimony, it can be really, really hard to tell these things apart. And so there's an ironic sense in which if Donald Trump is, in fact, as he repeatedly insists, innocent, you would think he would be the biggest fan of impeachment, as, in fact, other office holders have been in the past. It's essentially a dare to Congress to put up or shut up, that it should bring forward the evidence it has and start differentiating between those charges that can actually substantiate and those it shouldn't be lobbying because it lacks the evidence to sustain.
Let's talk more about the Andrew Johnson process, because it's really an intriguing part of the article that you write, and it really gets at your gifts as a history professor. So Johnson becomes the 17th president after Abraham Lincoln is killed. He's a Democrat. And part of what you're doing in the article is you say we need to recover the real story of Johnson's impeachment. So tell us a little bit about this case, because I was fascinated at the similarities, just some of the basic similarities, how Johnson is vain and egotistical, had a profane style that horrified the political establishment, not unlike Donald Trump. Talk a little bit about this historical element.
Yeah, I mean, when you start thinking about Andrew Johnson, I think many Americans don't spend a lot of time thinking about Andrew Johnson. But this is a man who runs on the ticket with Abraham Lincoln, although he is from the opposite political party. He's a Democrat and Lincoln's a Republican. He's the wartime governor of Tennessee and hates what he likes to call the slaveocracy. He hates the aristocratic class of the South and the institution of slavery for impoverishing poor whites. And so this is their point of commonality. They both hate slavery. Nobody expects Andrew Johnson to be president. Nobody's really voted for him to succeed to that office. Mm-hmm. But an assassin's bullet puts him there. So he comes in without a majority of Americans having put him in office. Johnson was a man who really got the passions of the crowd. And so when he gets in trouble in Washington, he does something no previous president has done. He goes on a speaking tour, what he calls the swing around the circle, and he gives this series of incendiary speeches attacking the press. At one point, he's giving a nighttime speech before a crowd in St. Louis, and somebody taunts him and says, why haven't you gone ahead and hanged Jefferson Davis? And his another supporter says, well, maybe we should hang Tad Stevens, who's the leader of the Congressional Republicans. And Johnson riffs off this. He often feeds off the energy of his crowds. He usually speaks in a free form and extemporaneous style. And there's the president of the United States essentially suggesting that people should lynch the leader of the opposition. It's a remarkable scene. He questions the legitimacy of Congress. He acts peremptorily and disregards a lot of the established procedures and safeguards and rules. And what we get is a clash between Johnson and Congress, and a really, really profound one. In a lot of ways, it's similar to the present circumstance in that Congress is a little slow to act, and it tries a bunch of things, and the system keeps breaking. So it passes a bunch of laws. Johnson issues statements interpreting the laws in ways that run contrary to their meaning, at which point Congress passes more laws to tell Johnson what the law had actually meant, and Johnson starts vetoing bills. And then we have a remarkable thing. For the first time in American history, Congress overrides a major veto, and you get a president asked to do what no previous president has been asked to do, which is to enforce a law that he has opposed and actively vetoed. And Johnson won't do it. He starts firing those office holders in the South who are attempting to enforce and uphold the law. And the struggle revolves around Reconstruction. Yeah. Will America be a nation in which blacks and whites are given legal equality? Or will it be what Johnson says he wants, a white man's government? And he puts it just that baldly. This is the fundamental clash. And Congress tries and tries to rein Johnson in. At one point, when there are vacancies on the Supreme Court, it shrinks the Supreme Court from 10 justices down to 7 just to keep Johnson from filling any of them. It's trying to constrain him. And Johnson bridles at this and ultimately fires the Secretary of War, which Congress understands not just as the violation of a law it has passed in order to try to rein Johnson in, but also as a fundamental challenge. If Johnson can fire the Secretary of War and take direct control over the military, he can end the project of racial equality. And that's what Johnson is trying to do, despite Congress repeatedly having passed laws upholding it, despite Congress amending the Constitution to uphold it.
Johnson is impeached on 11 counts, but fell just one vote short from being removed from office in the Senate. And you write about how Johnson's reporters, you know, went into the streets and to celebrate. But you talk about how the whole process It was seen as a failure, you know, like it didn't work. But Johnson survives. But you say it really tempered Johnson's behavior for the rest of his time in office. And it seems like maybe that's one of the lessons anyway of what happened.
Right. If the goal of impeachment is to remove Johnson immediately from office, it fails. It fails perhaps by bribery and patronage and threats and inducements, certainly by the nervousness of some members of the Senate about the president of the Senate who would have succeeded Johnson, of whom they are not fond. By then, General Grant has become the Republican nominee, and so some are content to just wait it out. But it comes within a single vote of succeeding, because there really isn't doubt that Johnson has violated the law here or about the nature of his overreach. And Johnson also saves himself, and this is really critical. He saves himself by giving up. First, he restrains his behavior as the proceedings get underway. And then he gives a series of promises to wavering senators in order to hang on to office. He's left as something like the head of state, but no longer the head of government. He will go on doing some things in office, but he has to promise to appoint a Secretary of War to control Reconstruction, who will be amenable to congressional direction. In fact, his nominee extracts that promise from Johnson as a condition of his nomination. He sends his proxies to Capitol Hill to promise that Congress can run Reconstruction from now on. So the great defining conflict which triggers impeachment, Johnson surrenders. He admits defeat. He says, now I will abide by the law. Now I will let Congress take the lead here. And he slinks out of Washington with his tail between his legs. He has been humiliated. He goes to the Democratic Party, which is staging a convention. Its slogan that year is, this is a white man's country, let white men rule. They're literally taking Johnson's words and turning it into a campaign slogan. And he says, why not me? Nominate me. And you know, I think comes in second in the initial round of balloting. It's a plausible thing. But he is seen as so damaged by the process of impeachment that they don't really want to touch him. And so impeachment destroys Johnson's national reputation, further welds his most hardcore supporters to him, but alienates the broad middle and leaves Johnson and his agenda discredited. It has one other really crucial effect, too. That debate is over what kind of a country America wants to be, a country in which all men are created equal, or a white man's country. Impeachment crystallizes and clarifies that debate. And in the process, it does something really interesting. It welds a strong majority against the notion that America is simply a white man's country, a majority that hasn't existed before the process of impeachment begins. It is Johnson's intransigence and Congress's action against him that polarizes public opinion and really builds public support for a much more aggressive program of Reconstruction. And so this is another benefit, not simply in terms of making Johnson back down, but it also defines the stakes for the public and ultimately will rally support not just for Johnson's removal from office or his defeat at the polls, but rather for a more expansive vision of American citizenship.
Mm. I remember not so long ago hearing the British conservative historian Neil Ferguson say that the 2016 election was so volatile that if Donald Trump hadn't won the election, that his supporters would have gone into the streets with, you know, if not pitchforks, I think he said semi-automatic rifles, in this very ugly mood. And he was saying that the election, this was his idea, that the election had relieved some of this pressure. And it made me wonder about how Donald Trump's base would react to the attempt to actually impeach him. Because this idea of diffusing the possibility of violence was, in fact, one of the rationales for impeachment. But say something about this.
You know, I wonder how many AR-15 owners Neil Ferguson actually knows. I'm not sure we're close to armed revolt in the streets.
Yeah.
There's a sort of condescension to that, that the belief that our fellow Americans are so, I don't know, simple-minded or lack faith in the system to such an extent that an electoral defeat would provoke open violence. And I do not share that view. And I don't share it as well because of what happened with Andrew Johnson, when exactly these arguments, almost word for word, were being leveled against the process of impeachment, only with a great deal more plausibility because America was 2-3 years removed from a bloody civil war that had claimed 750,000 lives. And so when people said this is going to lead to violence in the streets, what they meant was there's a demobilized army of several hundred thousand Confederates. They may take up arms again. They still have their weapons, right? It wasn't an abstract or theoretical thought. It was a very real one. And there is a night in Washington, D.C., after Johnson has fired the Secretary of War, when it appears that America may be headed back to another civil war. Rumors fly all over the place. Has Johnson been in touch with governors to ask them to mobilize their militia and march on Washington? The Union Army Veterans Organization starts coordinating by telegram, marching 100,000 veterans to Washington to stand by Congress. Johnson summons the commander of the Military District of Washington and tells him that really for aesthetic reasons he'd prefer if all of the black troops were quickly brought out of the Capitol and replaced by white troops. And so armed conflict appears quite plausible. The Secretary of War actually stations troops around the building to protect himself. And what diffuses it is impeachment. Armed conflict is a way to resolve constitutional disputes. It's the worst conceivable way to resolve constitutional disputes. The best one is the one actually built into the Constitution, which is impeachment. And there are literally headlines the next morning, armed conflict averted, impeachment proceeds through Congress. It is seen as the safety valve. We're having these fights anyway. There is violence anyway. There are protests anyway. You cannot point to America at present as a land of perfect civic peace and harmony. What impeachment does is it gives us a rule-bound process for having the fights that we might otherwise be having in the streets. And that is historically how it has worked. It has not been a provocation to further violence. It has rather been a tool for diffusing the potential for violence by telling Americans, look, we're going to put it out there. We're going to have a fair process. There's going to be evidence. There's going to be hearings. There's going to be votes. It's all going to be public, and you can watch and draw your own conclusions. And as you pointed out earlier, often that process has done something that armed conflict seldom does, which is to change his mind.
Yeah.
As people actually look and encounter the evidence, they may, as in the Clinton impeachment, decide that it is not sufficiently grave in kind to merit impeachment. Or they may look, and as was the case with Nixon, really with Johnson, decide that the president is indisputably guilty of the things that he's been charged with. And so that is the benefit of putting this fight in Congress and taking it out of the streets.
You point out in the article that how in Watergate, the ship of state had the capacity, as you put it, to right itself. But are you sure, Yoni Applebaum, that the norms and protocols today haven't been so fractured that they might actually not right the ship, that it could just get worse. I mean, it seems to require a real faith in the system, and it sounds like you have it. But I wanted you to say something about that finally.
Well, I'm a scholar of the past, not a fortune teller. So what I can say is how this has played out in the past when similar concerns have been aired. You know, Howard Baker, the man who would later become famous for saying, what did the president know and when did he know it, began that process by going to the Nixon White House and reassuring the president of his support. In the Watergate process, it did not begin with a bipartisan consensus that Nixon needed to go. Quite the contrary. We were living in a country with, you know, over the previous decade, literally thousands of incidents of violent terrorism, remarkable social conflict. I don't think you can point back to the late 60s and early 70s and say America today is more ideologically riven and, and more violent and more troubled. But what happened there, when you go back and you look at the oral histories and the interviews with the congressmen who would eventually turn against Nixon, the common theme was surprising to me. They didn't enter the process expecting to end up where they would. They thought that the charges against Nixon were politically driven. And part of the genius of our system is that it accounts for politics. It expects people to do things for political reasons. But then it gives us processes that allow us to take those self-interested actors and have them act in self-interested ways in ways that help restore balance to the system as a whole. So we have sort of the counterpoised political actors. And that's what happened with impeachment. Democrats, yes, hated Nixon for political reasons long before they were aware of his abuses of power, were only all too eager to be rid of him. But impeachment required that they bring along some of their Republican colleagues in the Senate eventually, and certainly they wanted the support of Republicans in the House. And as they sifted through the evidence, many of them talk about it in the same way. Not only did they suddenly come to understand that Nixon had actually done the things he was being accused of doing, but they had to ask themselves a profoundly troubling question. Not can I survive the next few years with Nixon in the White House largely enacting the policy agenda that I already support, but rather, if I don't act to rein in this president who is abusing his power in these ways, what will prevent the next president from the other party from doing precisely the same thing? That's a very difficult question for any member of Congress to answer. And if ultimately an impeachment of Donald Trump is successful, it's the question that will prove dispositive. It's not that anyone should expect Republicans in the House or Senate to look at Donald Trump and say, I'm upset with his judicial appointments or his environmental policies. But rather, one might reasonably expect them to look at him and say, as they just did on his emergency declaration, do I really want a precedent where a president of the United States can act like this? How will it be used against us after our party loses the White House? And do we have a responsibility to the system as a whole to step in while we can and constrain a president lest this become the standard by which future presidents are measured? Because if Congress does not move ahead with impeachment, if it does not at least go through with the process of holding the hearings and considering the charges, that will be tacit ratification by this Congress that nothing Donald Trump did rose to that level. And that will be the new standard for behavior by American presidents.
Yoni Applebaum. He's a senior editor at The Atlantic magazine, and his article, The Case for Impeachment, appeared in a recent issue of the magazine. He joined us from a studio at the Atlantic's offices in Washington, D.C. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.